Are you ready? Tane nodded, then shook her head. Me too. Onwen turned her face into the heavy rain. You will ride, Tane. The Medushi judge has based on our performance across all of the water trials, and you have done enough. This is the most important, Tane murmured. We will use swords more than any other weapon. If we cannot win a fight in a school, we all know how good you are with a blade. You're going to be fine. Tane twisted her hands between her knees. The others trickled outside. When everyone was present, the sea general emerged. The servant beside him craned on tiptoe to hold an umbrella over his head.
Your final trial is with swords, the sea general told them all. First, the Honorable Tane of the South House. She stood.
Honorable Tane, he said.
This day you will face the Honorable Terusa of the North House. Terusa rose from the benches without hesitation. First blood wins.
They walked to separate ends of the courtyard to collect their swords. Gazes locked, blades unsheathed, they walked towards each other. She would show him what village chaff could do. Their bows were small and stiff. Tane gripped her sword with both hands. All she could see was Terusa, his hair dripping, nostrils flared. The sea general called out, and Tane ran at Terusa. Sword clashed on sword. Terusa shoved his face so close to hers that she could feel his breath and smell the tang of sweat on his tunic.
When I command the riders, he hissed, I will see to it that no peasant ever rides a dragon again. A clangor of blades. Soon you will be back in that hovel they pulled you from.
Tane thrust at him. He stopped her blade just shy of his waist.
Remind me, he said, so only she could hear, where it was you came from.
He shoved her sword away.
Do they even give names to shit-heap villages?
If he thought to provoke her by insulting the family she had never known, he would be waiting 1,000 years. He swung at her. Tane parried, and the duel began in earnest. This was no dance with wooden swords. There was no lesson to be learned here, no skill to be refined. In the end, her confrontation with her rival was as quick and ruthless as having a tooth pulled. Her world was a torrent of rain and metal. Terusa sprang high, Tane sliced up, deflecting his downcut, and he landed in a crouch. He was on her again before she could breathe, sword flashing like a fish through water. She matched every blow until he fainted and punched her in the chin. A brutal kick to the stomach sent her sprawling. She should have seen that faint from leagues away. Her exhaustion had been her undoing. Through the droplets on her lashes, she glimpsed the sea general, observing them without expression.
That's right, villager, Terusa sneered. Stay on the ground, just where Chef belongs.
Like a prisoner awaiting execution, Tane lowered her head. Terusa looked her over, as if to decide where would hurt the most to cut her. Another step brought him within reach. That was when her head snapped up, and she swung her legs towards Terusa, forcing him into a leap to avoid them. She impelled her body away from the ground and whirled like a windstorm back to her feet. Terusa repulsed her first blow, but she had caught him off his guard. She saw it in his eyes. His footwork turned clumsy on the wet stone, and when her blade thrummed towards him again, his arm came up too slowly to block it. It shaved his jaw, soft as a blade of grass. A heartbeat later, his sword gashed open her shoulder. She gasped as he jerked away from her, teeth bared and slick with spittle. The other sea guardians were straining to see. Tane watched her opponent, breathing hard. If she had not broken the skin, the fight was lost. Slowly, rubies welled from the line she had drawn. Trembling and drenched, Terusa touched one finger to his jaw and found a smear, bright as a quince blossom.
First blood.
The Honorable Tane of the South House, the sea general announced, and he was smiling. Victory is yours.
No words had ever sounded sweeter. When she bowed to Terusa, blood oozed like molten copper from her shoulder. His face wheeled from the shallows to the depths of anger. He had fallen for the trick, a trick that should have fooled no one, because he had expected weakness. As he looked her in the face, Tane knew, at last, that he would never call her village chaff again. To call her that would prove that chaff could grow taller than grass. The only way to save face was to treat her as his equal. Under the cracked open sky,
The descendant of riders bowed to her, lower than he ever had. Chapter 17. West. Having been declared free of plague, Loth and Kit were admitted into the presence of the Donmarta Morosa several days after their arrival. During those days, they had kept to their rooms, unable to leave, with guards keeping watch in the gallery. Loth still shuddered at the memory of the royal physician, who had placed leeches where leeches should never be placed. So it was that Loth found himself walking with Kit into the cavernous throne room of the Palace of Salvation. The space was awash with courtiers and nobles, but there was no sign of Prince Wilston. The Donmarta Morosa, crown princess of the draconic kingdom of Iskallen, sat on a throne of volcanic glass beneath a canopy of state. Her head was encased in a horned mask of iron, shaped like the head of a high western. The weight of it must have been enormous. "Saint," Kit whispered, so low that only Loth could hear. "She wears the face of Firedale." Guards in golden armour stood in front of the throne. The canopy showed the badge of the House of Atalda, two black wyverns and a sword, broken in twain. Not just any sword, but Ascalon, the symbol of Virtudom. The ladies-in-waiting had folded back their plague veils, which hung from small but ornate coronets. Lady Priessa Yelagaris stood to the right of the throne. Now her face was revealed, Loth could see her pale, freckled cheeks, her deep-set eyes, and the proud bearing of her chin. The purr of conversation dwindled when they stopped in front of the throne.
"Radiance," the steward called, "I present to you two Innish gentlemen. Here is Lord Ardloth Beck, son of the Earl and Countess of Goldenbirch, and here is Lord Kitson Glade, son of the Earl and Countess of Honeybrook. Ambassadors from the Queendom of Innis."
Silence fell in the throne room, followed swiftly by hissing. Loth got down on one knee and bowed his head.
"Your Radiance," he said, "we thank you for receiving us at your court."
The hissing tapered off when the Donmarta raised her hand.
"Lord Ardloth and Lord Kitson," she said.
The iron helm made her voice echo strangely.
"My beloved father and I bid you welcome to the draconic kingdom of Iskallen. My sincere apologies for delaying this audience. I had business elsewhere."
"You need not justify it, Radiance," was all Loth said.
"You have the right to see us at your pleasure." He cleared his throat.
"Lord Kitson has our letters of credence, if you will accept them."
"Of course."
Lady Priessa nodded to a servant, who took the letters from Kit.
"When the Duke of Courtesy wrote to my father, we were delighted that Innis wishes to strengthen its diplomatic ties to Iskallen," the Donmarta continued. "We would hate to think that Queen Sabran would endanger our long friendship over religious differences."
"Religious differences?
Speaking of Sabran, it has been such a long time since I last heard from her," the Donmarta remarked. "Tell me, is she yet with child?"
A muscle flinched beneath Loth's eye. That she could sit beneath that blasphemous device and proclaim friendship to Sabran was repulsive.
"Her Majesty is not wed, madam," Kit said.
"But soon."
She laid a hand on each arm of her throne. When neither of them answered her, she said,
"I think you do not yet know the happy tidings, my lords. Sabran is lately promised to Obrecht Leavlin, High Prince of the Free State of Mentendon, my one-time betrothed."
Loth could only stare at her. Of course, he had known Sabran would eventually choose a companion. A queen had no choice in that. But he had always assumed it would be someone from Hroth, the more established of the two other countries in Virtudom. Instead, she had chosen Obrecht Leavlin, grand-nephew to the late Prince Leovart, who had also courted Sabran, despite the decades between them.
"Sadly," the Donmarta said, "I was not asked to attend the ceremony." She leaned back. "You look troubled, Lord Ardloth. Come, speak your mind. Is the Red Prince not worthy of bedding your mistress?"
"Queen Sabran's heart is a private matter," Loth bit out. "It is not to be discussed in such a place as this."
Laughter shattered the hush in the throne room, making his spine tingle. The Don Marta joined in merrily from behind her terrible mask.
Her Majesty's heart may be a private matter, but her bed is not. After all, they say the day the Barethnet bloodline ends, the Nameless One will return to us. If she means to keep him bound, had Sabran better not get on with the business of opening her country to Prince Albrecht? More laughter.
I pray the Barethnet bloodline continues to the end of time, Loth said, before he quite knew what he was doing, for it stands between us and chaos. In one smooth movement, the guards unsheathed their rapiers. The laughter stopped.
Careful, Lord Ardaloth, the Don Marta said. Do not say anything that could be construed as speaking ill of the Nameless One.
She held a hand towards the guards, who put away their blades.
Do you know, I heard tell that you were to become Prince Consort. Did you prove too low to love a queen?
Before he could protest, she clapped.
Never mind. We can remedy your lack of companion here in Iskallen. Musicians, play the 30 turns. Lady Priessa will dance with Lord Ardaloth.
At once, Lady Priessa stepped down to the marble floor. Loth steeled himself and walked towards her. The dance of 30 turns had once been taught in many courts. It had been outlawed in Innis by Gillian V, who deemed it lewd, but later queens had been more lenient. Most courtiers learned it in one way or another. Lady Priessa curtsied as the consort struck up a sprightly tune. Loth bowed to his partner before they both turned to face the Don Marta and took hands. At first, his legs moved stiffly. Lady Priessa was light on her feet. He skipped in a circle about her, never letting his heels touch the floor. She shadowed him. Hither and thither they pranced and sprang, side to side and face to face. Then the music surged, and with one hand on the small of her back and the other on her waist, Loth raised his partner off the floor. Over and over he lifted her, until his arms ached and sweat welled on his face and nape. He could hear Lady Priessa catching her breath. A coil of dark hair came loose as they spun around each other, slowing with each step, until at last they joined hands to face the Don Marta Morosa again. Something crunched between their palms. Loth dared not look at her as he took whatever she had slipped into his hand. The Don Marta and her court applauded.
"You are tired, Lord Ardaloth," came the voice from the mask. "Was Lady Priessa too heavy for you?"
"I think the gowns in Iskallen weigh more than the lady's radiance," Loth said, breathing hard.
"Oh no, my lord, it is the ladies, the gentlemen, all. Our hearts are heavy with grief that the Nameless One has not yet returned to guide us."
The Don Marta rose.
"A long and peaceful night to you."
The helm tilted.
"Unless there is anything you wish to ask me."
Loth was painfully aware of the paper in his hand, but this was an opportunity. "One thing, Radiance," he cleared his throat. "There is another ambassador in residence at your court, who has served Queen Sabran here for many years, Wilston Finch, the Duke of Temperance. I was wondering where in the palace he lodges, so we might speak to him." No one moved or spoke.
"Ambassador Finch," the Don Marta finally said. "Well, Lord Ardaloth, you and I are both in the dark on that front. His Grace left several weeks ago, heading for Corvugar."
"Corvugar?" Loth echoed. It was a port in the far south of Iskallen. "Why would he go there?"
"He said he had business elsewhere, the nature of which he did not disclose. I am surprised he did not write to Sabran to tell her."
"I am also surprised, Your Radiance. In fact," Loth said, "I find it difficult to believe." There was a brief silence as his implications settled over the throne room.
"I hope, Lord Ardaloth," the Don Marta said, "that you are not accusing me of lying."
The courtiers had pressed closer, like hounds with the scent of blood. Kit gripped Loth by the shoulder, and he closed his eyes. If they were ever to find out the truth, they had to survive this court, and to survive, they would have to play along with its rules.
"No, Your Radiance," he said. "Of course not. Forgive me."
Without speaking again, the Don Marta Morosa glided out of the throne with her ladies. The courtiers began to murmur, jaw clenched. Loth turned his back on the line of guards and strode through the doors, Kit hurrying at his heels. She could have had your tongue ripped out for that, his friend muttered.
Saint man.
What possessed you to all but accuse a princess of lying in her own throne room?
I cannot stomach it, Kit. The blasphemy, the deceit, the barefaced contempt for Innes.
You can't let them see that their taunting has worked. Your patron is the Knight of Fellowship. At least give these people the impression of that virtue.
Kit caught his arm, stopping him in his tracks.
Arteloth, listen to me. We are no use to Innes dead.
Sweat was beading on his face, and his pulse was distinct in his neck.
Loth had never seen him look so worried.
The Knight of Courtesy is your patron, Kit, Loth sighed.
Let us hope she will help me to mask my intentions.
Even with her help, it will not be easy.
Kit walked to the windows of the gallery. I masked my anger with my father all my life, he said softly. I learned to smile as he sneered at my poetry, as he called me a hedonist and a milksop, as he cursed his lack of other heirs and cursed my poor mother for not giving them to him. He breathed in. You helped me to do that, Loth, for as long as I had someone I could be myself with, I could bear to be someone else with him.
I know, Loth murmured, and I promise you that from now on, I will show my true face only to you.
Good. Kit turned back to him with a smile. Have faith, as you always do, that we will survive this. Queen Sebran is to be wed, or exile will not be long. He clapped Loth on the shoulder. In the meantime, let me find us some supper. They parted ways. Only when Loth had secured the door to his chamber did he look at the scrap of parchment Priessa Yellarigus had pressed into his hand. The Privy Sanctuary, at 3 o'clock. The door is beside the library. Come alone. The Privy Sanctuary. Now the House of Vitalda had abandoned the six virtues. It would have been left to gather dust. This could be a trap. Perhaps Prince Wilston had received a note like this before he disappeared. Loth ran his palms over his head. The Knight of Courage was with him. He would see what Lady Priessa had to say. Kit returned at 11 that night with lamb drenched in wine, a block of spiced cheese, and plats of olive bread with garlic. They sat on the balcony to eat while the torches of Cascaro flickered below. What I would not pay for a food taster, Loth said, picking through the meal.
Tastes superb to me, Kit said, his mouth full of oil-dipped bread.
He wiped his mouth. Now, we must assume that Prince Wilston is not sunning himself in Corvuga. Nobody with a wit goes to Corvuga. Nothing there but graves and crows.
You think his grace is dead? I fear it.
We must know for certain. Loth glanced towards the door and lowered his voice. Lady Priessa passed me a note during the dance, asking me to meet her tonight. Perhaps she has something to tell me.
Or perhaps she has a dagger and means to introduce it to your back.
Kit raised an eyebrow.
Wait, you're not going, are you?
Unless you have any other leads, I must. And before you ask, she stipulated that I must go alone. Kit grimaced and drank.
The Knight of Courage has lent you his sword, my friend.
Somewhere in the mountains, a wyvern screamed a war cry. A deathly chill scraped through Loth.
So, Kit said, and cleared his throat. Or Brackley Evelyn, the former betrothed of our worm-headed Don Martyr.
Aye, Loth gazed at the starless firmament. The Evelyn seems a respectable choice. From what I've heard, he is kind and virtuous. He will make Sab a fine companion.
Doubtless, but now she will have to marry him without her dearest friend beside her.
Loth nodded, lost in memory. He and Sebran had always promised that when they wed, they would give each other away. That he would miss the ceremony was the final twist of the knife. Seeing his face, Kit let out a theatrical sigh.
Pity us both, he said. I made a solemn promise to myself that if Queen Sebran ever married, I would ask Kate Withy to dance with me and unmask myself as the man who's been sending her lovelorn poems these past 3 years. Now I shall never discover if I have the metal.
Loth allowed Kit to distract himself while they finished their supper. Fortunate indeed that his friend had come with him on this journey, or he would have gone mad by now. At midnight, the palace grew quiet as the Iskals began to retire. Kit returned to his chamber, after exacting a promise that Loth would knock on his door on his return from meeting the lady. A bell tolled somewhere in Cascaro every hour. Close to 3 o'clock, Loth rose and slid his base lard into the sheath at his side. He took a red-flamed candle from one of the holders and left the colonnade. The library of Isala Rico formed the heart of the Palace of Salvation. As Loth walked towards its doors, he almost missed the corridor on his left. He approached the door at its end, found the key in its lock, and stepped into the darkness of the Privy Sanctuary. The glow from his candle flickered on the vaulted ceiling. Prayer books and broken statues were strewn across the floor. A portrait of Queen Rosarium was among the ruins, the face knifed almost beyond recognition. All evidence of virtudom had been stashed in here and locked away. A figure stood before the stained glass window at the end of the sanctuary. She held a candle with a natural flame. When he was close enough to touch her, Loth broke the silence. Lady Priessa.
No, Lord Ardaloth. She lowered her hood. You look upon a princess of the West.
In the clean flame of her candle, her features were made plain to him. Brown skin and dark, heavy brows, an eagle nose. Her hair was black velvet, so long that it reached past her elbows, and her eyes were such a striking amber that they looked like topaz. The eyes of the House of Vitalda.
Don Marta, Loth murmured.
She held his gaze. The sole heir of King Sigoso and the late Queen Sahar. He had seen Marosa Vitalda once before, when she had come to Innis to celebrate the 1,000-year anniversary of the foundation of Ascalon. She had still been engaged to Albrecht Lievelin then.
I don't understand.
He tightened his grip on the candle. Why are you dressed as your lady-in-waiting?
Priessa is the only person I trust. She lends me her livery so I can move about the palace undetected.
Were you the one who came to collect us from Perunta?
No, that was Priessa.
When Loth started to speak, she held a gloved finger to his lips.
Listen well, Lord Ardaloth. Iskallen does not only worship the Nameless One. We are also under draconic rule. Fyrdell is the true king of Iskallen, and his spies lurk everywhere. It was why I had to act the way I did in the throne room. It is all a performance. But you seek the Duke of Temperance. Finch is dead, and has been for months. I sent him to carry out a task for me, in the name of Virtudom, but he never returned.
Virtudom? Loth stared at her. What do you want from me?
I want your help, Lord Ardaloth. I want you to do for me what Wilson Finch could not.
Summer was on its way out. A chill was on the breeze, and the days were growing shorter. In the Privy Library, Margaret had shown Iad a knot of lady beetles, nestled in the scrollwork of a bookshelf, and they had known it was almost time to travel downriver. A day later, Sobran had decreed that the court would move to Briar House, one of the oldest royal palaces in Innis. Built during the reign of Marian II, it sprawled in the outskirts of Ascalon and backed onto the ancient hunting ground of Cheston Forest. The court usually journeyed to it in the autumn, but since Sobran had elected to marry Lievelin in its sanctuary, it would take up residence there earlier than usual. The moving of the court was always a chaos of folding and packing. Iad had departed with Margaret and Lenora in one of many coaches. Their possessions, locked in trunks, had followed. Sobran had ridden with Lievelin in a coach with gilded wheels. As the procession trundled down Berethnet Mile, the sweeping thoroughfare that divided the capital, the people of Ascalon had waved and cheered for their queen and their soon-to-be prince consort. Briar House was cosier than Ascalon Palace. Its windows were forest glass, its corridors laid with honey-coloured stone in a chequered pattern, and its walls, black brick, which held in warmth like nothing else. He had liked it well. 2 days after the court had arrived, she found herself at a dance in the candlelit presence chamber. Tonight, the queen had told her chamberers and maids of honour to go and enjoy themselves, while she played cards with her ladies of the bedchamber. A viol consort played gentle music. Iad sipped her mulled wine. It was strange, but she was almost sorry she was here and not with the queen. The privy chamber at Briar House was inviting, with its bookshelves and fireplace, and Sobran playing the virginals. Her music had grown melancholy as the days went by, her laughter tapering into silence. Ead looked to the other side of the room. Lord Satan Combe, the Nighthawk, was watching her. She turned away, as if she had not seen him, only for him to approach, like a shadow, crossing a patch of sunlight.
"Mistress Durian," he said.
He wore a livery collar, with a pendant shaped like a book of manners.
"Good evening."
Ead dipped a small curtsy and spruced her face into a mask of indifference. She could bite down her loathing, but she would give him no smiles.
"Good evening, Your Grace."
There was a long silence. Combe studied her with his peculiar grey eyes.
"I have a sense," he said, "but you do not think well of me, Mistress Durian."
"I do not think of you often enough to have formed any opinion of you, Your Grace." The corner of his mouth flinched.
"A fine hit."
She made no apology. A page offered them wine, but Combe refused it with a gesture.
"Do you not partake, my lord?"
he had asked civilly, even as she imagined stretching him on one of his own racks.
"Never. My ears and eyes must always be open for danger to the crown, and drink works hard to close them both."
Combe softened his voice.
"Whether you think of me or not, I wanted to reassure you that you have a friend in me at court. Others may whisper about you, but I see that Her Majesty values your counsel, as she values mine."
"That's kind of you to say."
"Not kind, merely truth."
He made a polite bow.
"Excuse me."
He walked away, parting the crowd, and Ead was left wondering. Combe did nothing without purpose. Perhaps he had talked to her because he needed a new intelligencer. Perhaps he thought she could wring knowledge about the Aesir from Chasar and pass it on to him.
"Over my dead body, bird of prey."
Albrechtly Evelyn occupied one of the high seats. While Sobran hid in her apartments, her betrothed was always among her subjects, flattering the Inish with his enthusiasm. At present, he was talking to his sisters, who were fresh off the ship from Zeodir. The twins, Princess Bodona and Princess Patrice, were 20. They seemed to spend their days laughing at secrets known only to those who had grown together in the womb. Princess Ermuna, the eldest sister and heir apparent, was half a year older than Sobran. She was the spit of her brother, tall and arresting, with the same pallid complexion. Thick crimson hair that rippled to her hips. Her sleeves were slashed to reveal a lining of gold silk that pulled in with 6 brocaded cuffs apiece, each cuff representing a virtue. The Inish maids of honour were already tying ribbons around their own sleeves to imitate her.
"Mistress Durian."
Ead turned and then curtsied low.
"Your Grace."
"Aladine Teldon, Ut Cantmarkt, Dowager Duchess of Zeodir, and grandmother of Trude, had come to stand beside her. Coin-sized rubies dripped from her ears.
"I was most curious to meet you."
Her voice was silvery and mellow.
"Ambassador Uk Ispad says you are his pride and joy, a paragon of virtue. His Excellency is too kind. Queen Sobran also speaks well of you. It pleases me to see that a convert can live in peace here."
Her gaze flicked towards the high seats.
"We are more free-minded in Ventendon. I hope our influences will soften the treatment of sceptics and apostates in this country."
Ea drank.
"May I ask how you know His Excellency, Your Grace?"
she asked, steering for a safer topic.
"We met in Brigstad many years ago. He was a friend of my companion, the late Duke of Zeodir,"
the Dowager Duchess said.
"His Excellency was at Janart's entombment."
"My condolences."
"Thank you. The Duke was a kind man and a tender father to Osgard. Trude takes after him."
As she looked towards her granddaughter, who was deep in conversation with Chasar, her face tightened with sudden grief.
"Forgive me, Mistress Durian." "Sit with me, Your Grace,"
Ead guided her to a settle. "Child, bring my lady some more wine," she added to a page, who sprang to obey.
"Thank you."
As Ead perched beside her, the Dowager Duchess patted her hand.
"I am well."
She accepted the wine from the page.
"As I was saying, Trude..."
"Trude really is the very image of Janart. She has inherited his love of books and language, too. He had so many maps and manuscripts in his library. I could hardly think where to put them all after his death. Of course, he left most of them to Nicolaes."
That name again. Would that be Dr. Nicolaes Roos? He
Yes, he was a great friend to Janart, she paused, and to me, even if he did not know it. He was here during my first year at court. I was sorry that he left. It was not by choice. The Dowager Duchess leaned closer, so Eard could smell the rosemary in her pomander. I should not say this to most, mistress, but Ambassador Uck Ispad is an old friend, and he seems to trust you. She opened a folding fan and hid her lips with it. Maclay's was exiled from court because he failed to make Queen Sabran an elixir of life. Ea tried not to change her expression. Her Majesty asked him to do this? Oh, yes. He arrived in Innes on her 18th birthday, not long after Janart died, and offered her his services as an alchemist. In exchange for her patronage, I assume. Indeed. Many royals had sought the water of life. Playing on the fear of death must be a lucrative business, and there had long been rumours at court that Sabran feared the childbed. Roose had preyed on a young queen, dazzling her with his knowledge of science. A charlatan. Nicolaus was no fraud, the Dowager Duchess said, as if she could read Eard's mind. He truly believed he could make it for her. The elixir was his passion for decades. There was a note of sadness in her voice. Her Majesty gave him great lodgings and a workshop at Ascalon Palace, but from what I understand, he lost himself to wine and gambling, and used his royal pension to pay for it. She paused to let the page top up her glass. After 2 years, Sabran decided that Nicolaus had swindled her. She banished him from Innes and decreed that no country that craved her friendship could give him refuge. The late Thai Prince Leobart elected to send him to Orisima, the trading post. I assume Her Majesty has not relented on the subject of his exile? No. He has been there for 7 years. Eard raised her eyebrows. 7. From what she understood, Orisima was a tiny island, if island were not too grand a word for it, that clung to the Sycanese port of Cape Hissan. 7 years there would drive a person mad. Yes, the Dowager Duchess said, seeing her face. I beseeched Prince Albrecht to have him brought home, but he will only do so if Queen Sabran pardons him. Do you not believe he deserves to be in exile, Your Grace? He adventured. After a hesitation, the reply came. I believe he has been punished enough. Nicolaus is a good man. If he had not been so deep in mourning for Janart, I do not think he would have behaved the way he did. He wanted to lose himself. He had thought of the name on Trude's little book of heresy. Nicolaus. Had the girl intended to use Roose in her plan? I suppose your granddaughter also knows Dr. Roose, she said. Oh, yes. Nicolaus was like an uncle to her when she was young. The Dowager Duchess paused again. I understand you have some sway with Her Majesty. As one of her ladies, she must hold your opinion in high regard. Now Eard understood why this noblewoman had come to speak to her. The Teldon of Cantmarkt understand commerce, the Dowager Duchess said, her voice soft. There was a lit cinder of hope in her gaze. If you speak for Nicolaus, I can make you a rich woman, Mistress Durian. This must be what happened to Roslane and Catrian. A hushed request, a sweetener, a whisper to Sabran. What Eard could not understand was why it was happening to her. I am not one of the ladies of the bedchamber, she said. I do not presume to have Her Majesty's ear. I think you are far too modest, the Dowager Duchess smiled a little. I saw her walking with you in the Knot Gardens just this morning. Eard took a sip of wine, buying herself a moment. She could not get involved in dealings like these. It would be folly to speak for someone Sabran despised when the Queen had only just showed an interest in her. I cannot help you, Your Grace, Eard said. You would be better served asking Lady Roslane or Lady Catrian. She stood and curtsied. Excuse me, I have duties elsewhere. Before the Dowager Duchess could press her on the matter, she made her way towards the doors. The royal bedchamber in Briar House was much smaller than its counterpart at Ascalon Palace. The ceiling was set low, the walls panelled with dark linen fold oak, and crimson drapes surrounded the bed. Eard was early, but she found Margaret sitting inside. Eard, she said. Her voice was thick with the cold that had buckled half the court. Now you've spoiled the surprise,
I ought to have arrayed the bed before you got here, so I could continue making idle conversation with nobles I scarcely know. So you could dance. You used to love to dance. That was when the sight of the night hawk did not make me as bilious as it does now. With a sound of distaste, Margaret rose, a letter in her hand. Is it from home? He had asked. Aye. Baba says that Papa has been asking to see me for weeks. Apparently he has something important to tell me, but I could hardly go to him in the middle of all of this. Sir Bram would let you. I know she would, but Mama insists I stay here. She says Papa most likely has no idea what he's saying, and that it is my duty to remain. But in truth, I think she is living through me. With a sigh, Margaret tucked the letter into her bodice. You know, I was fool enough to think the master of the posts would have something from Loth. He may have written. He had helped her lift a fustian. Combe intercepts every letter. Then perhaps I shall write a letter saying what a cur he is, Margaret muttered. He had smiled. I would pay to see his face. Speaking of which, she added quieter, I was just offered payment of my own in exchange for petitioning the Queen. Margaret looked up at her, eyebrows raised. Who from? The Dowager Duchess of Zeodor. She wants me to speak for Nicolay's rules. That will do you no good. Loth told me Sir Bran hates that man with a passion. Margaret glanced at the door. You be careful, he had. She lets Ross and Kate get away with it, but Sab is no fool. She knows when the whispers in her ear are too sweet. I have no intention of playing those games. He had touched her elbow. I think Loth will be all right, Meg. He knows now that the world is more dangerous than it seems. Margaret snorted. You think too highly of his wits. Loth will trust anyone who smiles at him. I know. He had took her by the shoulders and steered her to the door. Now, go and drink some hot wine at the dance. I'm sure Captain Lintley would be pleased to see you. Captain Lintley? Yes, the very gallant Captain Lintley. Margaret was a little bright-eyed as she left. Lenora was nowhere to be seen. No doubt she was still dancing. He had secured the royal bedchamber alone. Unlike the room at Ascalon Palace, it had two entrances. The great door was for the Queen, the little door for her consort. There had been no attempts on Sir Bran since the betrothal was announced, but Eid knew that it must only be a matter of time. She checked the feather bed, looked behind the curtains, searched every wall and tapestry and floorboard. There was no secret third way in, she was sure, but the possibility that she had missed something nudged her. At least Chassa had laid new wardings on the threshold, stronger than her own. He had recently eaten of the fruit. Eid plumped the little pillows and replenished the closet. She was closing a hot coal into a bed warmer when Sir Bran stepped into the room. He had stood and curtsied. Majesty. Sir Bran looked her up and down with half-lidded eyes. She wore a sleeveless rail over her nightgown and a blue sash around her waist. He had never seen her so undressed. Forgive me, he had said to fill the silence. I thought you would not retire until later. I have slept ill of late. Dr. Bourne tells me I should try to retire by 10 o'clock to promote a quiet mind or some such, Sir Bran said. Do you know some cure for sleeplessness, Ead? Do you take anything presently, madam? Sleep water? Sometimes cordial, if the night is cold. Sleep water was the Innish name for the decoction of Setwall. While it had some medicinal properties, it was clearly doing little good. I would recommend lavender, earth apple and cream grail root simmered in milk, he had said, with one spoonful of rose water. Rose water? Yes, madam. In the Ursir, they say the scent of the rose brings sweet dreams. Slowly, Sir Bran unfastened her sash. I will taste your remedy. Nothing else has worked, she said. When Kate comes, you may tell her what to bring. He had approached with the barest nod and took the sash from her. Sir Bran's eyes were circled with shadow. Does something trouble your majesty? He had helped her out of the rail. Something that disquiets your sleep? It was meant in courtesy, with no expectation of an answer. To her surprise, Sir Bran gave one. The worm. Her gaze was on the fire. He said the 1,000 years were almost done. It has been just over 1,000 years now since my ancestor vanquished the Nameless One. There was a furrow in her brow. Standing there in her nightgown,
She seemed as vulnerable as she would have looked when the cutthroat had beheld her.
Worms have forked tongues for duplicity, madam.
He had hung the rail over the back of the chair. Fyodel is still weak from his slumber, not fire yet fully lit. He fears the union of Berethnet and Lievelin. He speaks in riddles to sow misgiving in your mind.
He has succeeded. Sebron sank onto the bed. It seems that I must wed, for Innes.
Ead did not know the acceptable way to reply to this.
Do you not wish to wed, madam?
She finally asked. That matters not.
Sebron had power in all things but this. To conceive a legitimate heir, she must wed.
Roslane or Catrian should be here. They would soothe her fears while they combed her hair for bed. They knew the right things to say, the right way to comfort her while keeping her in the state of mind necessary to her union with Prince Albrecht.
Do you dream, Eard?
It came from nowhere, but Eard kept her composure.
I dream of my childhood, she replied, and things I have seen around me by daylight, woven into new tapestries.
I long for that.
I dream of terrible things, Sebron murmured. I do not tell my ladies of the bedchamber, for I think they would be afraid of me, but
I will tell them to you, Eard Durian. If you will hear them, you are made of firmer stuff.
Of course.
She curled up on a rug beside the fire, close to Sebron, who sat with a taut back.
I dreamed of a shaded bower in a forest, she began, where sunlight dapples the grass. The entrance is a gateway of purple flowers.
Sabra flowers, I think.
They grew at the end of the known world. It was said that their nectar glowed like starlight. This far north, they were legendary. Everything in the bower is beautiful and pleasing to the ear. Birds sing charming songs, and the breeze is warm, yet the path that leads me on is jeweled with blood.
Eard nodded her reassurance, even as something glinted in the back of her mind.
At the end of the path, I find a great rock, Sebron continued, and I reach out to touch it with a hand I do not think is mine. The rock breaks in two, and inside, her voice wavered.
Inside.
A chamberer did not have leave to touch the royal person. And yet, seeing that drawn face, Eard found herself reaching for Sebron and clasping one of her hands between her own.
Madam, Eard said, I am here.
Sebron looked up. A moment passed. Slowly, she moved her other hand to cup the braid of their fingers.
Blood overflows from within the cleft, and my arms, my belly, are awash with it. I step through the rock into a standing circle, like those in the north, and scattered all around me are bones, small bones.
Her eyes closed, and her lips quaked.
I hear terrible laughter, and I realize the laughter is mine, and then I wake.
Eard kept the queen in her gaze.
Sebron had been right. Roslane and Catrian would have been frightened.
It is not real.
Eard tightened her grasp.
None of it is real.
There is a story in this country of a witch, Sebron said, too far into her memory to hear. She stole children and took them into the forest. Do you know it, Eard?
After a moment, Eard said, the Lady of the Woods.
I suppose Lord Arteloth told you, as he did me.
Lady Margaret.
Sebron nodded, her gaze distant.
They tell it to all the children in the north.
Warned them to stay away from the Haythwood, where she walked.
She lived long before my ancestor, and yet the fear of her lingers among my subjects.
Goose flesh stippled her neckline.
My mother told me stories of the sea, not the land. I never believed in a lady of the woods. Now I fear there was a witch, and that she lives still, working her sorcery upon me.
He had said nothing.
That is but one dream, Sebron said. On other nights I dream of the childbed, as I have since I had my first blood. I lie dying, while my daughter struggles out of me. I feel her tearing my body, like a knife through silk. Between my legs, waiting to devour her, is the Nameless One.
For the first time in the 8 years Eard had been at court, she saw tears bead on Sebron's eyelids.
The blood keeps flowing, hot as iron in the forge. It clings to my thighs, sticks them together. I know I am crushing my child, but if I let her breathe, she will fall into the jaws of the beast.
Sebron closed her eyes. When she opened them, they were dry.
That nightmare torments me the most. The weight of the crown had taken its toll on her. "Dreams reach deep into our past," he had said quietly. "Lord Arteloth told you the story of the Lady of the Woods, and it has come back to haunt you now. The mind often wanders to strange places." "I might agree with you," Sebron said, "had I not had both dreams since long before Lord Arteloth had shared that tale with me." Loth had told Eid once that Sebron could not sleep without a candle. Now she knew why.
"So you see, Eid," the queen said,
"I do not sleep because I am not only afraid of the monsters at my door, but also of the monsters my own mind can conjure.
The ones that live within."
Eid held her hand a little tighter. "You are Queen of Innis," she said. "All your life you would have known that you would one day wear the crown." Sebron watched her face. "You fear for your people, but cannot show it to your court. You wear so much armor by daylight that by night you can carry it no longer. By night you are only flesh, and even the flesh of a queen is prone to fear." Sebron was listening. Her pupils were large enough to almost block the green from her eyes. "In darkness we are naked, our truest selves. Night is when the fear comes to us at its fullest, when we have no way to fight it." He had continued. "It will do everything it can to seep inside you. Sometimes it may succeed, but never think that you are the night." The queen seemed to mull this over. She looked to their hands and slowly circled her thumb in Eid's palm. "More of your comely words," she said. "I like them well, Eid Durian." Eid looked her in the eye. She imagined two gemstones falling to the ground, shattering from within. Those were the eyes of Sebron Barethnet. Footsteps just beyond the threshold. Eid stood and clasped her hand in front of her just as Catrian came in with her arm around Lady Arbella Glen, who was in her nightgown. Sebron reached out to her oldest bedfellow. "Bella," she said, "come to me. I want to discuss the marriage preparations with you." Arbella smiled and hobbled to her queen, who took her by the hand. With dewy eyes and a serene expression, Arbella stroked Sebron's black hair behind her ear like a mother tending to a child.
"Bella," Sebron murmured, "never weep. I can't bear it."
Eid slipped away. Once Sebron and Arbella were abed, Eid told Catrian about the decoction, and though the mistress of the robes looked skeptical, she sent for it. Once it was tasted and delivered, the royal apartments were sealed, and Eid took her position for night duty. Caliba. That was the name the Lady of the Woods had gone by in Lassia. Little did the Innish know that the witch was very much alive, though far away, and that the entrance to her lair was guarded with Sabra flowers. Sebron had never seen the Bower of Eternity. If she was dreaming of it, something was afoot. Hours tiptoed by. Eid remained still, watching for any movement between shadow and moonbeam. Sidon allowed her to cloak herself in darkness. A cutthroat, no matter how skilled, did not have that gift. If another one came to either of the doors, she would see them. Close to one of the clock, Roslane Crest, who was also on night duty, appeared with a candle.
"Mistress Durian," she said.
"Lady Roslane."
They stood in silence for some time.
"Do not think me unaware of your intentions," Roslane said. "I know full well what you are doing, as does Lady Catrian."
"I was not aware I had given you offence, my—" "Do not take me for a fool. I see you moving closer to the queen. I see you trying to curry favour with her."
Her eyes were dark as sapphires in the gloom.
"Lady Trude has said that you are a sorceress. I cannot think that she would make such an accusation without reason."
"I took the spurs and the girdle. I renounced the false faith of the Dawnsinger," Eid said. "The Knight of Fellowship tells us to embrace the converts. Perhaps you should listen to him better, my lady."
"I am the blood of the Knight of Justice. Be careful how you address me, Mistress Durian."
Another silence rang between them.
"If you truly care for her," Roslane said, softer, "I take no issue with your new standing. Unlike many Innish, I have nothing against converts. We are all equal in the eyes of the saint. But if you only seek gifts and riches, I will see to it that you are cut from her side."
"I seek no gifts or riches. only to serve the saint as best I may, he had said. Can we not agree that no more of her friend should be cut from her side? Rosalind looked away. I know Loth was fond of you, she said, with what Eard could see was a degree of difficulty. For that, I must think the best of you. With still more difficulty, she continued, forgive my caution. It is wearisome to watch the spiders that surround her, who only think to climb the... A cry rose from the royal bedchamber. Eard spun to face the door, heart thumping. She had no movement from the wardings. No cutthroat could have entered that chamber. Rosalind stared at her, lips parted, eyes wide. Eard took the key from Rosalind's frozen hand and ran up the steps.
Hurry, Eard! Open it! Rosalind shouted. Captain Lintley! Sir Gules!
Eard turned the key in the lock and flung open the door. The fire burned low in the hearth.
Eard!
A shape moved on the bed.
Eard, Ros, please, you must wake Arbella!
Sabran, ravels of hair escaping her braid.
I woke and reached for her hand, and it was so cold, she sobbed. Oh, saint, say it is not so.
Captain Lintley and Sir Jules Heath appeared at the door, swords drawn.
By the saint, Lady Rosalind, is she hurt? Heath barked.
While Rosalind hastened to her queen, Eard circled to the other side of the bed, where a small figure lay beneath the coverlet. Even before Eard searched in vain for a pulse, she knew. A terrible hush descended as she moved away. I am sorry, Your Majesty, she said. The two men bowed their heads. Rosalind began to weep, one hand over her mouth.
She did not see me wed,
Sabran said, faintly. A tear ran down her cheek.
I promised her she would.
Chapter 18. East. The journey to the capital was hideous. Nicklaes was jounced along for days in the stuffy palanquin, with little to do but doze, or squint at bits of scenery between the wooden blinds. Gunnera lay north of the Bear's Jaw, the mountain range that guarded Cape Hissan. The trade road cleaved to the foothills before it struck a crossway. Ever since the day Nicklaes had arrived in Psyche, it had been his dream to visit Gunnera. Back then, he had been grateful for the chance to live in a place few Westerners would ever see. He remembered being called to Brigstad Palace, where Leovart had broken the news that Sabran had ordered his expulsion from Virtudom. He had thought her rage quenched after Satan Combe had questioned him at length in the Dern Tower about his misuse of Barethnet money. Naively, he had believed it would be a short exile. Only after the third year had he understood that the tiny house on the edge of the world was to be his final resting place. That was when he had stopped dreaming of discovery and had dreamed only of home. Now he could feel his old curiosity in the world awakening. On the first night of the journey, they stopped at an inn in the foothills, where Nicklaes bathed in a hot spring. He looked at the far-off lights of Cape Hissan and the ember that was Erissima. And for the first time in close to 7 years, he started to feel as if he could breathe again. The feeling did not last long. The next morning, the chair carriers began to complain about the owl-faced ment they were lugging north. The spy of a prince who spat upon dragons, who must have the red sickness in his breath. Certain words were said in return, and from that point on, the jolting grew worse. The chair carriers also began to sing about an insolent man no one liked, who was left crying on the side of the road for the mountain cats to take away.
"Yes, yes, very funny," Nicklaes barked at them in Psychonese. "Shall I sing about the four chair carriers who fell down a cliff and into the river never to be seen again?"
All that did was make them laugh. Countless things went wrong following that incident. A handhold broke off the palanquin.
"Great Quiriki, wash away this owl man!"
and they were forced to delay their journey while a carpenter was fetched to repair it. Once they were on their way again, the chair carriers finally let Nicklaes sleep. When he heard voices, his eyes cracked open. The chair carriers were singing a lullaby from The Great Sorrow. Hush, my child, the wind is rising. Even the birds are quiet. Stop your tears, the fire breathers will hear us. Sleep now, sleep. Or you will see them coming. Hold on to me and close your eyes. There were cradle songs like this in Mentendon. Nicklaes strained his memory,
to when he was small enough for his mother to sit him on her lap and croon to him while his father drank himself into rages that had left them both quaking in fear of his belt. Fortunately, he had drunk himself into such a fury on one occasion that he had been good enough to stumble off a cliff, and that was the end of that. For a time, all had been peaceful. Then was when Helch and Ruse had convinced herself that her son would grow up to be a sanctarian and atone for the many sins of his father. She had prayed for that outcome every day. Instead, Nicolas had become, in her view, a morbid hedonist who spent his time either slicing open dead bodies or tinkering with potions like a sorcerer, all while drinking himself sodden. This was not, Nicolas conceded, a baseless impression. To her, science was the greatest sin of all, anathema to virtue. Of course, she had still written to him at once when she had discovered his unexpected friendship with the Marquess of Zierder and Prince Edvard, demanding he invite her to court, as if the years she had tormented him about every facet of his existence were nothing. He and Janart had made a sport out of finding ways to destroy her letters. Thinking of that made him smile for the first time in days. The trill of insects in the forest sent him back to sleep. After two more painful days, during which he thought he might die of the heat and boredom and confinement, the palanquin stopped. A bang on the roof shunted him from a doze. Out. The door slid open, letting in a glare of sunlight. Nicolas got down blearily from the palanquin, straight into a puddle. Galleon's girdle! One of the chair carriers lobbed his cane after him. They hefted the palanquin onto their shoulders and turned back to the road. "Hold on a moment!" Nicolas shouted after them. "I said, hold, damn you! Where am I to go?" Laughter was his only reply. Nicolas cursed, picked up his cane, and trudged towards the west gate of the city. By the time he reached it, the hem of his robe was soaked, and sweat dripped down his face. He had expected soldiers, but there was nobody in armour to be seen. The sun burned on the crown of his head as he entered the ancient capital of Psyche. Genura Castle was a behemoth. The white-walled complex bestowed a great hill in the middle of the city. A friend had told Nicolas that the path in its gardens were made of seashells, and its saltwater moat sparkled with fish, their bodies clear as crystal. He walked past the bustling markets of what he assumed was Seabed Town, the outermost district of the city. Its stone-paved streets billowed with oil-paper umbrellas and fans and hats. This close to court, people wore cooler shades than they did in Cape Hassan, green and blue and silver, and their hair was waxed and wound into ostentative styles, adorned with sea-glass ornaments, salt flowers and cowrie shells. Robes here were slippery and lustrous, so when the wearer moved, they glistened in the sun. Nicolas dimly remembered that it was the height of fashion in Genura to appear as if you had just emerged from the sea. Some courtiers even oiled their eyelashes. Necks were encircled by branching coral, or tiny plates of steel arranged to look like overlapping fish scales. Lips and cheeks sparkled with crushed pearl. Most citizens were forbidden to wear dancing pearls, as they were the symbol of the royal and god-chosen. But Nicolas had heard that misshapen ones without a core were often powdered and sold to the wealthy. In the shade of a maple, two women batted a featherball to one another. The sun sparkled on the canals, where merchants and fishers unloaded their wares from graceful cedar boats. It was difficult to imagine that most of this city had burned down in the Great Sorrow 5 centuries ago. As Nicolas walked, unease eclipsed his wonder. The chair carriers, damn them to the womb of fire, had taken the letter from the governor, along with all his other possessions. That meant he could now be mistaken for an outsider, and he could hardly go up to Genura Castle to explain himself in this state. The sentinels would think him a cutthroat. Still, he had no other choice. People were catching on to his presence. Nervous looks came at him from all directions. "Dr. Roos?" The voice spoke in Mentish. Nicolas turned. When he saw who had hailed him, he beamed. A fine-boned man in tortoise-shell eyeglasses was weaving his way through the crowd. His black hair, cut short, was grey at the temples. "Dr. Moyaka," Nicolas called, delighted. "Oh, Izaru, how marvellous to see you!" Finally, some good fortune. Izaru was a gifted surgeon Nicolas had taught for a year in Orissima. He and his daughter, Perume, had been among the first to sign up for anatomy lessons, and never in his life had Nicolay seen two people so willing to learn. They had taught him a great deal about Cycone's medicine in exchange for his knowledge. Meeting them had been a bright spot in his exile. Izaru broke free of the throng, and they bowed to one another before embracing.